So, welcome to our first episode of Real Punks. My name is Jamie.
I'm Tom.
So, just give you a little bit of background about who we are before we start. We're going to talk about films every week, probably. We tend to, me and Tom have been spending a lot of time talking about films after we've watched them on his big projector doodah. And we would talk about films for quite a long time after we watched them, so we thought we'd just record stuff and put it on the internet, which is how you're probably listening to it now.
So today, tonight, we're going to watch Solaris, which is a film that I've seen before and Jamie hasn't.
Sorry, because you borrowed it off me. I lent it to you, didn't I?
Okay. So this is the most recent remake of Solaris.
2002.
Is it? Or three?
I think it was, it said two on the end. On the back of the
book. Okay, with Steven Soderbergh directing and George Clooney as the lead. I don't think either of us have seen the original.
I've not seen the original, no.
No, or read the novel. So I suppose we're watching it as a bit of a standalone, but we'll see how it goes. So, we ready?
Yeah. Well, I was going to give you a little bit of background about who I am.
Oh, okay, right.
And yeah, I guess you could do the same. So I'm Jamie, I'm 25, live in Manchester in the UK, obviously.
Well, there is a Manchester in the States, I think.
Is it in Pennsylvania?
I don't know.
That's Westchester. Oh, who cares? Who cares, Tom?
Who gives a shit?
I'm 25, I study journalism, and I write for a few websites and stuff, and I listen to podcasts, and that's why I sort of talked Tom into doing this. Mm-hmm. What about you, Tom? Who are you?
Well, Tom, oddly enough.
How are you?
I live in Manchester as well. I am doing a PhD at the moment in computer science in Manchester Uni. I just decided, I think a couple of years ago, I set my sights on buying a projector, maybe 3 years ago or so, and about a year ago finished building up a home cinema setup surrounding that, and I've been watching a lot of films since for the obvious reason, and I think the projector probably came before really actually fully enjoying films as opposed to the other way around. I'm not really sure why that happened, but it did.
It's true. When we first met, you used to say that you couldn't understand watching films for their bad, just for how bad they were.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you got over that.
And since then, we've seen
To the Limit was the pinnacle, wasn't it?
To the Limit, Undefeatable.
Undefeatable, Cynthia Rothrock.
Just some fucking amazing, atrocious films, but also some utterly fantastic ones.
Yes.
And you know, as I said, I've seen Solaris before, and I do think it's utterly brilliant, which is why I'm showing it to Jamie this evening.
Like, our tastes differ quite massively, but like the overlap tends to be pretty good.
Mm.
Like, I'm more about sort of cult and horror films.
Yeah, I think generally, if it's a stellar film, if it's if there's a film that either of us really like, then we tend to both like it.
It's true.
There are some that
Just thinking about your sentence there. There's a film that we both like. We tend to both like it.
Okay, well, I'll rephrase that. If there's a film that either of us like a lot, then the chances are that we'll both like it to some extent.
Apart from Quiz Show.
Yeah, apart from Quiz Show, which I didn't like at all. And I've yet to be convinced about Westerns at all.
Well, I'm sure we'll get to a couple of Westerns.
Yeah.
The way we're going to structure this is each week one of us will choose a film to tell the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously this week you've shown Solaris. So I think that's enough waffle for now, and we can get on with watching Solaris, and we'll be back after this to give you our thoughts or whatever.
Are you tired of film podcasts where the hosts exist in a constant blissful state of agreement?
I mean, the main characters are two of the dullest main characters I have ever encountered in any film.
Well, you're in luck. Let me introduce you to Chinstro Crumpunter. One is an ex-film student with a penchant for David Lynch and art cinema. The other is a man on the street. Listen in perplexed and horrified terror as we tear apart one film a week.
It just really
isn't. It's not visually striking.
No.
Just getting confirmation.
It's just in English. That's the third time, though. I mean, is this on?
You can find us at chinstrokerversuspunter.podomatic.com. So come and share the victory.
If you could any man in film, who would it be and why?
My answer is Lance Henriksen.
Oh.
He wouldn't tell. He looks like somebody. He looks like somebody who can keep a secret.
So, Why did you love that so much? I'm not going to get into what I think of it just yet, but why did you love it so much? Charles V. Bender.
I really think it's just like perfectly rounded. It's a film that makes me realise that there are so many dimensions of other films that I've just never noticed before. So, to take the most glaring example, I think
the heaven allegory.
Pardon?
The heaven allegory.
No. In terms of if the different dimensions are, lighting, score, and so on. The most obvious thing in this that pushes the film forward for me that I've never really noticed. Nice one, brilliant timing.
Yeah. Sorry, Karen.
So the score, there's that kind of theme throughout the whole thing where there's these twinkly kind of xylophone pieces with a driving kind of repetitive rolling bass line underneath it, just a really simple three chord sequence.
Yeah.
And that's always put over these general kind of atmosphere building scenes. So you get this just general crescendo of feeling. And that's a really lame way of describing it, but I don't know. That particular example where they're kind of where he's having flashbacks kind of midway through the film, and he's sitting on the train and sees that woman, and then they go to the party, and that's the part where that music's in. That's always where it really throws me full on into the film. That's where I think it really kicks off. And then there's just loads of little nice things that are done with the lighting. I think the general colour palette in the film is really nice. You've got all the greys of the spaceship, and then that glaring blue purple of Solaris, and then on Earth all the tones of these kind of muted greens that fit together really well with it.
It is really beautifully shot.
Yeah, I think it's shot. I love the shooting of it. I really like. I like the pace of it. I like that it's almost achingly slow.
I might go as far as say it's too beautifully shot.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's so beautiful that you sort of lose what's actually going on.
Yeah, I agree with you to an extent. And a lot of the beauty of the shots hangs on the fact that, and this is that score, right? Just really, really simple, incredibly simple bass line. You couldn't get away with making a score that was more simple than this. It's impossible.
I wonder who did the score. I'm sure we'll get there. Credits are rolling.
We might have missed it already. It hangs off this long, beautiful shot. So Solaris in this is almost just an excuse for this big, beautiful sphere where, it can just make these beautiful marbled patterns.
It's a really refined version of the stuff that you used to get in Windows Media Player.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of appropriate as well. If this was the music you were putting through Windows Media Player, that's what you'd want to see.
Exactly, yeah.
I think the story is great.
The idea that Insane Clown Posse were on the soundtrack made me feel sick.
Yeah, that as well, yeah.
It totally,
What is with this? I missed that.
They were the first bit when you meet.
When the mad guy.
Yeah. And you meet Daniel Faraday. Not Daniel Faraday because that's his character in Lost.
Right. Okay. Another thing that occurs to me is that I normally have no interest at all in romances in film, and I think this one is brilliant. Because I've seen this before, putting it into chronological order in my head is a bit tricky, but knowing that he's got this romantic encounter with this woman, this romantic engagement with her, and not really fully understanding it and having it gradually revealed to you,
yeah,
and finding out that it ended so tragically, which is why there's all this weight on her just turning up in the middle of space.
I think that's, it's all fairly obvious though. I mean, you never really know, but it's fairly obvious.
Yeah, you know that she's obviously dead.
Yeah.
But you don't know that, you know, they had these kind of intimacy issues that means that when she got an abortion, he stormed out and she committed suicide. You know what I mean? Like, it changes completely, like the weight of, like, what's going on between them.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't know. I could go on...
Well, going nuts, I'm gonna leave it alone then.
I mean, I forget things as I, like, I'm sure there's other things as well that I thought of during the film. Like, it literally, as soon as it starts, like the first scenes when he's sitting on the train and just immediately the shooting and the cadence of it and the tone just made me fall in love with it straight away.
I have serious issues with George Clooney as an actor. He has this really naturalistic style that I like a lot, but I also find it very difficult to remove him from his roles where he's George Clooney, basically, like his Ocean's 11 roles. And
you mean like his persona as George Clooney leaks into places that it shouldn't be?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean, and but then that was the other thing that I was going to get to that I'd forgotten. Was that I think the acting in this is awesome as well. Like,
apart from Daniel Faraday, he's awful.
No, but I like him so much more the second time round than I did the first. Like, the first time I just thought, like, what is he doing? Like, why have they just put this, like, madly eccentric character in the middle of like a really, like, I don't know, you know, kind of what I mean, like, not demure, like, low, like, kind of very slow, kind of very, like, very quiet, like, neat cut. And I can't think of the word to describe the rest of the characters, but, like, he's obviously, like, the exact antithesis of them.
Yeah.
But I think that actually, I think that's really cool. Like, I think it works.
I was fine with the character.
Mm.
I think that actor, I don't know what his name is, but I think he's, like, miscast. I think I've seen him in a few other things. He played Charles Manson in a TV movie of the Manson family or whatever.
Right. Okay.
And he's got a way. He's got, like, his way.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that applied to this character at all.
I mean, I guess we're in a slightly different situation in that I did for one second wonder what he looks like when he's playing other characters, because obviously that character is so distinct. The one.
Well, that's what he looks like all the time.
It's always the way he gesticulates and okay. Well, in that case, yeah, that's a bit more of a problem. But I don't know. I like George Clooney in this. I like, you know, the first line he has when he's in his psychiatrist's office and he's talking on the phone. I just, you know, it's very natural and it's very smooth.
Yeah,
and
he's a really naturalistic actor. I think he's one of those actors that doesn't trade on his looks, but does. Doesn't have to trade his looks, but still trades on his looks anyway.
Yeah.
Same as Brad Pitt, even though Brad Pitt can pull out a wicked performance too. Yeah. And but Johnny Depp to a lesser extent as well, but Johnny Depp always acts against type rather than...
Yeah. But I think, I mean, in this case that's kind of necessary, because I think one of the main threads in this film is, like, two crushingly beautiful people in a romance, like, set in an amazingly beautiful environment.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't, you know, it's necessary for when you cut from a shot of Solaris, when you cut to a shot of the, like, the leading lady, that, you know, she is equally as beautiful as the scene before, like, to keep the, and I think they chose that actress perfectly. Like, I think she is. I think
she's got a really, besides the fact that she's incredibly beautiful and attractive, she's also got this really expressive face.
Yeah. And I think one situation where, like, and this kind of ties in with the acting in general, she uses it really well when she has this epiphany that, like, that there's something really, really wrong with what's going on. Like, she realises that the fact she doesn't remember anything, like, she has this huge personality crisis. And he tries to give her a tablet, and, you know, keeps asking her if she's all right, and she keeps saying yes, but she says it in such a way which is just like, which is just, I don't know, like he keeps trying to reassure her and she keeps saying, yeah, that's fine, yeah, and it's just so obvious that she's unconvinced.
Yeah.
Like, the first time I saw that, I thought it was, well, you know, when the first time I saw that scene starting, I thought it was really horrific acting until I realised that exactly what she was trying to do was just this completely, like, you know, like playing the lines completely without any personality, literally like intending to have no conviction in the delivery, because that's what actually the character was trying to do.
I thought the first break in her acting, maybe the only break in her acting, was the first time she gets like visibly upset. I felt like she either she wasn't, when Clooney goes to leave and the first
one when he puts her in that pod.
No, but like before then, when he's like, oh, check on something, and she's like,
yeah, she gets screaming.
Yeah, like I didn't buy that at all.
Yeah,
I think that was like a real sort of drop in her acting. Like she's clearly, she's really good throughout the film, apart from that one part. I thought it just sort of pulled me out of it a little bit.
But I think also, I mean, it was such a dramatic departure from the tone of like the events leading up to it.
Yeah.
I think I generally found the whole thing a little bit unbelievable. I'm not sure if like there was any other way that she could have acted that. I mean, it was too jarring of a moment. Like, I don't think that particularly worked, that part. And there were other parts where I couldn't really figure out if like she was delivering a particular kind of character or if she just wasn't really pulling it off properly.
Yeah, like that bit as well, when I was thinking about it, the bit where she gets upset at the idea of him leaving her in a room on her own.
Yeah.
Is that based on the memory of when he left last time she committed suicide? Or is it, like, the first thing I thought when I saw that character do that was that she knows that she's not real and when he leaves the room, she's going to cease to exist?
Yeah, I thought that was the idea, that, like, even if she doesn't know it kind of consciously, she's got this, like, subconscious impression that her entire reality hinges upon this one guy, because all she's got is his memories.
Yeah.
So if he disappears, she's not anything anymore.
Well, but, like, later on, when you find out that she is suicidal because that's how he remembers her...
Yeah.
Then...
Well, no, that's just her suspicion. Like, she claims that as a support.
But, like, a lot of suspicions and assumptions are, like, assumed as reality within the film. Like, when the doctor woman, what's her character called?
I can't remember, really bad.
Gordon.
Yeah.
When she says, like, back to where they came from.
Yeah.
In relation to the ray gun, effectively, that they make that sends... That destroys their particles. Like, that's a complete assumption, because how do they know?
Yeah, no, but I think that's completely different from the, like, so, yeah, okay, that's an assumption about, like, the whole reality of how the whole thing works, but when Rhea says, you know, I'm suicidal because that's the way you remember me, like, she's making an argument to justify her being allowed to commit suicide.
But she...
Like,
well, that's true. Right.
She doesn't really have any, like, inherent knowledge about the way the whole thing works. Like, she's just putting forward, like, suppositions. And I don't think they're necessarily related to any of the other, like, hypotheses that other people make.
Well, I mean, it's all written by the same person, so...
No, but what... Yeah, okay. Yeah, I see what you mean, but I do think those are two distinctly different instances.
Yeah, no, I agree. So we should probably talk about the religious allegory.
Is there one?
Well, of course there is.
I always miss these things.
There's that massive section in the middle where they're talking about whether God exists or not.
Right,
and what the idea of God would be if he was to exist.
Right.
And if you get a scene like that in a film, it's obviously something... within the film is about God and what God represents and what God means. Mm. Or the idea of God, anyway. Like, I don't understand what other reason there would be for a scene like that.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I mean, I guess I didn't read into it any more than it being like a basis for a disagreement between the two. Like, so, you know, like for it to show kind of like a fundamental like difference in the philosophy of the two people, like,
yeah,
you know, because up until then, like, all of the romance had built a like a very harmonious relationship, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, okay. I mean, fair enough.
And then I think it was affirmed at the end when she said, "What was her character said? All your sins are forgiven here." Was it that? Was it as on the nose as that? It was something like that.
She didn't use sins, like, but yeah, she did say it's talking about forgiveness.
Yeah, everything's forgiven here, or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, she also talked about when, you know, he says, "Am I dead or alive?" And she says, "We don't need to think in those terms anymore."
Yeah,
but. Yeah, so when you point it out to me, I can see there being a religious allegory, but, like, I, both times I've watched it now, I've thought of that in a purely, like, in a purely sci-fi sense, in the idea that, you know, they are these kind of transcendent beings that don't have to, like, consider mortality anymore.
Yeah.
And I suppose that inherently is, like, well, okay, I mean, that does kind of put it in the ballpark of, like, spirituality, but then on the other hand, it doesn't have to be, like...
No.
You know.
Well, I always believed that sci-fi is just now things that we want to say, but told in a way that makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You could talk about the nature of God and religion and
the
idea of, like, poverty and murder and death and all that shit as well. Well, obviously, I'm not in this film, but you can do it in a way that makes it slightly more sort of hypothetical or theoretical.
But actually, I find the idea of these beings made transcendent by Solaris, you know, with no relationship to kind of any previously standing like religious philosophy.
No.
I find that what I'm saying is I find that idea by itself a lot more interesting than some kind of religious allegory. Like, I just think, as you know, it stands alone as an idea, it leaves a lot more like room for imagination, and you know, I think it would be kind of tenuous to try and pin down like close links between any of the themes in this film and a particular religious philosophy.
No. Well, I think I agree, and while like the I think that's probably the intention is to say this is, or to imply this is similar to what might happen in any given religious belief, but it also stands alone. I think that's the many depths of science fiction, really.
Yeah.
You can watch it and say that's a film, I've watched it. You can watch it like I hear a lot about Inception, and a lot of people say Inception. I haven't seen Inception yet, obviously, but this is a podcast, so.
Yeah.
Got to say that, but I haven't. Yeah, so I haven't seen Inception, and I hear a lot of people say that Inception. I don't understand why Inception's so difficult, because it's really easy. And then other people say, well, Inception's really intelligent and blah blah blah. And that's because you can watch it and it's just a film, or you can watch it and you can take every effort to read every little.
Yeah, I mean, I think the case with Inception is slightly different in that, like, following the mechanics of the film itself.
Yeah.
Is at least a little bit tricky. It's not that difficult at all, but I think the difference is that, you know, if you compare like Inception to say like the most recent Star Trek film, it's possible to get lost in one and not in the other. Like, you know, some people do struggle just following the basic thread of Inception. Having said that, I don't agree with people who say that, you know, okay, so once you've got the basic threat, there are all these other like layers to it that you can investigate. Like, I think it's fairly straightforward after that.
I think there'll always be layers to it, because it's science fiction is always a way to say something that you want to say in a way that people might not need to hear it unless they decide to look for it.
Yeah, okay, but like, you there's varying degrees of ambiguity, right? Like there's you know, you can make different films with different amounts of room for interpretation.
Yeah.
So like this really just kind of Solaris just hangs in the background and just has these weird effects on these people in the spaceship. And no one ever really kind of properly describes exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And so you're left with this huge room for manoeuvre, like to think about like what might be happening. And then it concludes with this, you know, completely unexplained event that leaves these two beings of some like indeterminate state in a world that they may or may not know anything about, because they may or may not have been there, you know, like, it's just so open-ended, and I really, really like that.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case in Inception at all. I think it's fairly, relatively square.
Well, like I said, I haven't seen Inception, so I can't.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's not that big a deal anyway. Like, I wasn't trying to make too much of a point off it. But I do like the amount of room this gives you to play with, like.
I definitely think that there's some intended religious subtext within that film, at least.
Okay. I mean, I guess it's one of those things that, like, I always completely miss when it comes to films. You know, like, it always just goes over my head because, I suppose partly just because, you know, religion has played such a almost like non-existent part in my life. When I watch stuff that, you know, is making allusions to certain parts of religious philosophies, they just kind of pass me by.
But I guess it's similar to when we watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah.
And then Downey Jr.'s voiceover saying, "Oh, why was that scene in the movie? Do you think that'll come back later?" I think it's a case of just like everything that happens in a film happens because it's supposed to happen. So nothing in a film is like incidental,
mm-hmm.
unless it's meant to be incidental.
Yeah, although
especially in a film so as deliberate as Solaris.
But things get away from you, like, in the sense that I mean, the reason that there are, you know, universities full of people who are writing interpretations of literature is because inherently when you build something that's bigger than, like, you know, a 10-minute story or a 20-page story, which is really, really clear and really obvious, the longer your story goes on for, the more detail it gets, the more room there becomes for little threads of kind of sub-stories which maybe you haven't intended to build.
Yeah.
And the more room there is for different interpretations of things. So, you know, yeah, okay, even though, like, all of the filming and all of the script is, you know, clearly set up, things arise from that you can never have predicted, if you know what I mean. So, like, it's entirely possible that this film was meant as just a really, you know, on the nose religious allegory, and these interpretations that I'm coming up with, which I think are reasonably, like, logically sound.
No, I agree.
Completely unintended, but still kind of hold their own. And there are probably like 100 other interpretations that could still, like, you know, could still be logically sound, but were completely unintended by, like, the writer and the director.
I'd be interested to read the source novel, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they bear very much relation to each other at all.
No, I agree.
I've not read it, and I don't know that much about it. The only things that I do know is, I mean, the main reason I haven't read it is because it was translated via French, and the author, who could read English but never got around to translating into it, read this translation and said he was disappointed with it.
Right.
And it's never been translated directly. But from what I've been told, the relationship between this, the first film, and the book is that it's all fairly loose. I mean, if there's religious overtones in this, then it's unlikely that there are in the book, given that it was written, I think, in Soviet Russia.
Right.
But then on the other hand, if you were going to write something with religious overtones in Soviet Russia, you would hide it in a sci-fi.
Yeah. I'm trying to make an in Soviet Russia joke, but I can't think of anything.
In Soviet Russia, sci-fi criticizes you. I don't know. It's not very good, but, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay. I mean,
in Soviet Russia, heaven comes to you. So then you go to heaven.
That just makes it sound like a really bad, like, Eastern European brothel.
I don't think there are bad. I've seen some Eastern European porno, and they all seem to be fairly attractive.
Fair enough.
That's the general consensus I get from Eastern European women.
Okay. All right. Well, that's the conclusion for today. That Eastern European brothels are the places to be.
They are.
I don't know. So on the whole, you weren't that into it.
No, I loved it.
Oh, okay. Good. Good. I'm really pleased. I didn't think you were going to enjoy it.
There was. It was fairly predictable.
Really?
To a point. I knew the first time he met that character. I knew the first time his wife came back.
Yeah.
The bearded guy character wasn't the real guy.
Really? Okay.
Just because he was so out there.
Right.
And I didn't know. I'm not going to say that I knew, but I suspected.
Right.
I called it. That's the only like revelation, I guess.
Okay. The other thing that I really like, that again, I'm not going to get the benefit of again because, you know, I've watched it now. But when he actually arrives at Solaris, and well, as an aside, like, I really like those scenes where he arrives and you just got these kind of big, beautiful shots of the spaceships passing in front of Solaris. Like, I just think they look amazing. But then he arrives and he gets onto this ship, and you just have no idea what's going on at all. Like, you're completely clueless. And you are for quite a long time, until his wife just turns up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And, when that happens, you kind of don't really know what's going on. And then I think one of the parts that I really like is when, like, he gets out of bed, like, jumps out of bed because his wife's next to him, and he walks around the room, like, not looking at her, like, just trying to bash it out of his brain, and then it cuts to a kind of close-up on him, and you see him just kind of get up the courage to look back, and she's still there, and obviously he goes nuts. And
yeah. One of the things I really liked that I read as this, but I don't know if that's what was intended or what, but in the section just before that, when he's lying down and he's sleeping, and he keeps seeing a close-up of his face, and then his memory, and a close-up of his face, his memory, and they gradually, like, the close-up becomes shorter and the memory becomes longer.
Yeah.
I read that the same, it does it later with the female character.
Right.
I read that as almost like, if you look at something long enough, you start to understand it more, you start to, like, just sort of see more of it. If you really look at something for a long time, you will understand more about that thing. Mm-hmm. That's how I read those sections.
Okay.
I really quite liked that idea. I don't know if that's...
Yeah. I mean, there's also a practical, from the storyteller's perspective, there's also like a practical dimension to it of, you know, being able to kind of insert this new character into the film.
Yeah.
Like, because it's meant to be jarring that she turns up, because obviously someone who's dead has just turned up, and that's meant to jar you. But on the other hand, you want the dramatic intent, you want the dramatic tension of having them in there, and you want the jarring to be expressed through the character.
Yeah.
You know, jumping out of bed and going, what the fuck, as opposed to, like, they're just walking through the door and you having to, you know, if you like, kind of clear the table in order to explain this new event. But yeah, I know what you mean with kind of like gradually, so there's, you know, there's two things to that. Like, you know, you kind of repeatedly kind of spend time looking at this thing and having it open out to you, but also, like, it's a fairly nice device for kind of exposition to, you know, expose these characters' pasts without having to be, like... So, you know, when I watched a little bit of The Spirit earlier, there was just this, like, absolutely horrific scene where, you know, the main kind of superhero has just finished this fight and ends up kind of standing by a brick wall with a cat just staring practically into the camera, talking about the baddie that's now turned up in town, who used to be his girlfriend when he was a teenager.
Right.
And it's just so, like, it's so crude. It's
I haven't
so, like,
seen the spirit, and I literally don't want to watch it.
I wouldn't bother. Like, just spend like 10 minutes just saying, okay, these are the things you need to know so that we can carry on with the film.
Yeah. I think that happened in this as well, but it happened the first time we meet Jabarian, whatever his name is.
Jabarian. Yeah. Maybe.
He's basically explaining through the video at the beginning of the film. He's explaining some, like, the core bits of exposition that you need, but not anywhere near enough to get a handle on what's really going on.
Yeah, I mean,
I really liked that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like engendering a mystery, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's the complete opposite from saying, like, okay, we're going to have some events now. This puts everything in context. Like, it's literally the opposite in the sense that, you know...
Just leave your time in.
Yeah. Sorry, you know, it opens up this mystery for you, and that's part of what I've had so much tension to,
yeah,
to, you know, getting on board the ship in the first place.
Going back to what I was saying before about the sort of the extended close-ups of Clooney and the woman's face when they were having their sort of flashback times, they sort of come back to that again later in the film when you keep getting the close-up of Clooney's face,
yeah,
and then the different images of Rhea's face in like different situations, yeah, that they were in their lives. I think it was so beautifully shot. Steven Soderbergh, I don't even know if I've seen anything else that he's directed.
I don't know what else he's directed.
I know he did The Girlfriend Experience, which had Sacha Grey in it, which I'm interested in.
Really?
Seeing. Yeah.
What? Oh,
Sacha Grey's like a besides doing porn, she's also a serious actress now.
Yeah, I heard about that.
She was in a film called Smash Cut, which was fucking awful.
Soda, I don't know how to spell his name.
Soderbugh.
I'll probably get it.
I'll get it in the vicinity. There were a few things I didn't like about...
Ooh, he directed Ocean's 11.
Oh, of course he did. I've seen Ocean's 11 and 12, but not 13.
I think I've seen them all. At 13, I thought 13 was actually really good. They get to this point where they keep referring to the fact that who was Ellen Brockovich?
Oh, is it Julie? Oh, yeah, I have seen 13. Julia, she looks like some mysterious actress who you never talk about.
No, Julia Roberts. No. Yeah, but they never say she looks like a mysterious actress. They keep referring to the fact that she looks like Julia Roberts, and then she ends up
having to play to be Julia Roberts for Bruce Willis.
It's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It was fucking terrible.
I love it.
It was terrible. So yeah, there was a few things I didn't like.
Produced the Scanner Darkly.
I didn't like Scanner Darkly.
And Syriana. Didn't you? I thought you did.
It's watchable.
Alright, fair enough.
I didn't like it very much. Syriana is the George Clooney oil one. I haven't seen that yet.
I produced Welcome to Collinwood, which sucked.
You loved Welcome to Collinwood. I thought it was your number one film that you've seen this year.
Fuck off. Okay, so, yeah, I don't know what more there is to say on that. I thoroughly enjoyed that film.
Well, there was some stuff I didn't like.
Really? Like what?
Like... It was annoying because I really liked the fact that they didn't like smack you in the face with the fact that it's all futuristic. Like they all had these little futuristic touches that didn't matter.
Yeah.
Like the
I mean I generally like that whole aesthetic of things, like
the well, when he's on Earth I'm talking about, when like he's got the Minority Report TV and he's got like the future fridge.
It's just very seamless. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you get to space, he's got this fucking ridiculous future bed that's so incredibly impractical for no good reason. It's like sleeping on a bed of really rubbery looking bubble wrap. That's what it looked like to me. It looked fucking so uncomfortable.
Really?
Why can you not just put a mattress on a spaceship? Is that not allowed? And it had like Pizza Hut cheesy bites all the way around it. It was completely pointless.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, I see.
I thought the aesthetic of the spaceship was really... The spaceship. I thought the aesthetic of the ship was really nice. Apart from the bed.
Apart
it just looked so ridiculous. Like,
yeah, okay.
Completely unnecessary as a bed Like,
yeah, fair enough. I mean, yeah, all right. But it would have looked fucking weird with a double divan in there, right? Like, I mean, it just wouldn't have worked. I mean, there could have been like, yeah, some split between them.
Yeah. I guess to put a mattress on a spaceship would cost a lot more money than putting some really hard rubber down with a semicircle cushion thing for a head.
Yeah, I mean,
it just makes no sense.
But you don't get mattresses on ships.
But you don't get what do you get on ships? I've never been on a ship, to be honest.
But like, you know, it'll just be a bunk, won't it? I mean, again, it's the same, right? That's the point. It was a bunk. It was a space bunk.
But like, it didn't even look even remotely comfortable. And I assume when you go to space to live on a space station orbiting a bizarre Nova type thing.
I thought it looked quite comfortable. I'm fine with that.
Really?
On IMDb, it got a 6.2, and I think that's testament to the fact that everyone on IMDb is a fucking idiot.
I would say it's not worth more than a 7.
Really? Oh, I would. Solaris is in the high 9s for me.
The high 9s?
Yeah, easily. Like,
I think you're very generous.
I just think there's so little you can fault it on. Like,
The bed,
yeah.
Right. Kills 3 marks immediately.
The bed's fucked. All right, in that case, the high 6s. Yeah, I'll give you that. I really do. Like, I really do think it's that good.
I think I could probably put it at 7.5 at the highest. I wouldn't... Like, if you put it in the high 9s, that means it's nearly a perfect film.
But I think it is. But I think it really is. Like, the story, I just think, is... like through and through on the button, and I remember watching it the first time thinking, please don't ruin it with the end. And then they give this kind of like sufficiently ambiguous ending. Like, the other thing I completely forgot is, you know, he decides not to get in the escape ship, goes back into the ship, and, you know, ends up holding hand with this kid. Like, how the fuck does he get back on Earth, or where the fuck even are they? Like, what the hell is going on? Like, you know, and the fact that, like, you know, you're watching it and you're watching him stand outside the dock for the escape ship, and then it cuts to him on Earth talking about him just like going through the motions trying to get back into the rhythm, and then it just breaks you out of it because it cuts back to the spaceship and you realise he never does, and he just kind of presumably dies in this corridor as Solaris absorbs him. But like, you know, as it kind of says a bit too clearly, like, these motions of death, like, just don't really make sense in the context of Solaris. And so I just think the ending is, like, to build a film with that sense of drama and like that degree of kind of mystery and then not fuck up the ending is a massive feat. Like, I hate it. Like, it's like the opposite of Vanilla Sky, where they have all this like completely confusing drama and you're looking for the threads that tie it together and you're battling to figure out like what is it that makes this make sense, and then, oh, it's all a dream. Right, great.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, I think saying that this film is the opposite of Vanilla Sky is the most correct way of describing it in the world.
Yeah.
It literally is the complete antithesis of everything that Vanilla Sky stands for.
Yeah.
Whilst existing in a very similar space.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, exactly. And that's the thing. I remember watching Vanilla Sky and just thinking, I'm so excited about how this is going to end because I feel like it's just going to be one of those game-changing films. And then it ended with this just like horrific excuse for a conclusion, and that didn't happen here. And so, you know, storyline, like, filming, acting, casting, like, CGI, like, the
CGI was incredible.
Yeah,
we gotta talk about that as well. Like,
yeah, I mean, just
obviously the CGI is minimal.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
to a degree, I guess. I don't know if we would say it was minimal or not,
but that's the kind of point, right? You don't know. Like, it's so cleanly done that you have a lot of difficulty telling. I mean, obviously, the shots of Solaris are CGI because there couldn't be anything else.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like, it just nicely blends together. And, yeah, so I couldn't find fault with it on any other, like...
Well, there were a few problems I had with it.
Hmm.
The voiceover at the end, like, they've always... in all the books I've read on screenwriting, obviously I'm not Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah.
And I've never made millions and millions of dollars on an Ocean's film.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
But I don't think that qualifies you. I mean, making millions of dollars on an Ocean's 11 film.
Well, what I mean is, I'm not a director to the point where I get to go off with my friends and have a little fun holiday in Vegas with my friends every couple of years and make a film while I'm there.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But, like, I always find that voiceover is lazy.
I know what you mean. Like, and I remember when that came on, it jarred me a little bit, and I kind of thought, nah. But then I actually also, like, it also kind of pulled me back slightly to kind of slightly cheesy first-person sci-fi. Like, I can't think of any particular examples right now, but it gives a vague hint towards, like, sci-fi books written in the first person.
Yeah. Like, I don't think Rorschach text was sci-fi, but was that written in...
Yeah.
Was written in the first person, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's not... I guess it's not quite what I'm thinking about, though, because I'm thinking about kind of, like fairly cheesy, like, 80s, or maybe even, like, 70s, 60s, like, early sci-fi, where a lot of the exposition was, like, just first-person monologues.
Yeah.
Again, that might not be, like, what was intended at all. And, yeah, maybe it was a little bit lazy, but it also meant that, like, the story was rounded out and closed off, like, fairly neatly. And that was also, you know, it was also, it wasn't the main thrust of the story. They had to go into that and then get back out to go back onto the spaceship to conclude.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, they didn't need to. Like, he was on Earth.
Yeah.
We thought, right, he's gone back, and then he wasn't. It's like we didn't really need him to say, "I'm on Earth.
Yeah.
This is Earth. Yeah. I am on Earth now. This is Earth now. I am on it. Here is me on Earth."
Yeah, and I guess they could have shown a bit more of, like, just the monotony of daily life and kind of struggling to deal with it. But no, I really, like, if that isn't a high nine, I don't know what is. Like,
well, I made you watch Good, the Bad and the Ugly, didn't I? That's a high nine.
No, I didn't enjoy that at all. It's just not my kind of film, that's the thing.
I'm going to make you watch, at one point, I'm going to make you watch Once Upon a Time in the West.
Okay. Brick is a high nine. That's a high nine.
And there's a lot of problems with Brick as well. I mean, I love Brick.
No,
but there are a lot of problems. I mean, the chances are we probably won't watch Brick for the podcast because we've both seen it so many times.
Yeah.
But so we can sort of touch on it now a little bit. It's a really well made film, but it's not more than again a 7.5.
If Brick's like a 7.5, but the thing is, okay, so I mean. So 10 is my favourite film, and 0 is my least favourite film.
Well, I don't think there's a 10 film out there.
But that's my point, right? That's how I'm building my spectrum.
Right.
Because if Brick isn't in the high nines, and it's one of my favourite films that I've ever seen, you know, and that puts it at 7, like, what goes up in, like, 9.6, you know? Like, that's my point. Like, I can't imagine some end of the spectrum that I really know nothing about because I've never seen anything from it. So
yeah, it's true.
You know, so that's how I set my spectrum up. Like,
well, maybe in that case we probably shouldn't talk in terms of, like, out of tens or ratings because I generally I find ratings quite lazy anyway.
Yeah.
Because, like, what's the point in here are the thousand myriad things about this film that are amazing, and here are some things that weren't amazing. 7.10.
Yeah.
10 out of 10.
7.10.
Yeah.
Right. So 8 then.
So no, 7 out of 10. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't get across the subtlety
and the
insight of a review in a sort of an arbitrary number.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess all it's useful for is ranking it personally for me, above or below other films that I've seen.
Yeah, we should talk about that then. We should come up as our rating system. We should come up with five films that are, like, universally loved and say, was it better than these five films?
Or
any of those?
Yeah,
I think that'd be quite good.
I think that'd be useful.
A good rating system.
Yeah, and we'll have to find them roughly on the kind of 8. Well, if they're universally loved, they probably won't range from 8 through to, you know, 6, 4, 2, because that doesn't But yeah, we can get well-recognised films.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be tricky, though.
So, what about the science in the film? How was the science? When I watch a sci-fi film, I know nothing. Obviously, you're fairly clued up on science. To a degree.
I think I liked about it is it avoided talking about it too much.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing it could have really made. Like, you know, I mean, there was. I think the best way to avoid it when you're doing this kind of like, the best way to deal with it is just to stay well away from it. Like, so, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about physics, but I get the feeling that all of the physics in that was complete and utter nonsense.
Well, of course.
So far from like, so there's nonsense and then there's things that are just like so obviously stupid, like in the sense that, you know, they say, oh, so we've got these kind of visitors, these people, you know, things sent by Solaris, and someone says, are they made up of subatomic particles? And it's kind of a stupid question because atoms are made up of subatomic particles and people are made of atoms and, you know, everything is made from atoms. What would it tell you if you said something's made of subatomic particles? All it would tell you is that it's made of the same stuff that everything else is made of. Like, to be a pedant, I guess you could say, you know, is it made of esoteric subatomic particles? Something a bit more unusual.
I think what they were saying was, is it a thing, or is it like a visual representation of a memory or a thought?
Is it
an apparition, or is it a solid thing?
No, I get that. Like, and that's kind of like how I interpreted it. It's just that they could have just passed it over the desk of a physicist just to kind of say, well, let's phrase this very slightly differently. And like, you know.
What about their ray gun that they make?
Well, you know. Okay, so we're using a little DV camera to record.
Don't tell them too much. They don't want them to know how fucking amateur we are.
Yeah, this is an amateur game.
Amateur hour.
And the battery ran out. So we got cut off, I suppose.
We were just getting into the science of it, but I mean, the science of it really doesn't matter, so all of that would have been sort of spurious.
Well, you know, I think the science of it does matter, but I don't think there was a whole lot to talk about in that particular film, and I was definitely... I had already reached the limits of any knowledge I had on the matter, so... I think there are great sci-fis where the science is really well done.
Yeah, I mean, you're yet to see Primer, but I think the science in that was done really well.
Mm. Yeah, I've not seen that. I'm trying to think of some others that I can think of. Okay, so...
Battlefield Earth, the science is amazing.
I've not seen that.
Being sarcastic.
Okay. have you seen Contact?
That's the Sandra Bullock Aliens one, is that what it is?
No, it's Jodie Foster.
Jodie Foster, what am I thinking of? The Net. Yeah.
Okay.
That's a completely different thing.
So, in that, there is some very kind of odd science, which is fine in sci-fi, probably, you know, doesn't hold up to much in, you know, kind of real physics, I suppose. But the point is, it's this pretty intense story about the interface between science and religion, science and faith, I guess more broadly. That's done really, really well. So if you haven't seen that, we should probably watch that sometime.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
So I don't know if there are any concluding remarks. Although I suppose this is just a wrap up, just to cover the fact that, you know, our amateur equipment went tits up.
I think we got a decent amount of chat out of the back end of that movie, then 45 minutes worth or whatever.
Yeah.
So. I did really like it. I know that I didn't come across like I loved it, but I thought it was amazing. It was visually stunning,
mm-hmm.
almost a little bit too much. Like, if you ever want to talk style over content, I think there was, it wasn't style over content much like, say, Sin City was, or Avatar, to use a fairly recent example.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the style was so strong that it almost overshadows the content, rather than being all about the visual and not having nothing to back it up. I think that sometimes it might have sort of overshadowed it a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think, having said that, I really, really enjoyed Koyaanisqatsi. I don't know if I ever showed that to you.
You tried to show it to me a bunch of times and I really... I find it incredibly boring, but I almost bought the soundtrack.
But that,
I saw
that's
it the other day in a second show.
Yeah, I mean that's a film that is. I mean, there is content in there, but it's massively subsumed to the visuals and the style, and it's a difficult film to describe without probably a lot more time than we have in concluding remarks. But my point was that, you know, I'm kind of okay with that, you know, in the same way that you get films that are really strong on content and pretty poor on filmmaking.
Yeah. So, things that we've learned from this episode is that we need to not waffle on so much and not pay attention as to whether we're recording.
Yeah.
We need to devise our arbitrary rating system in which we choose
some
films, whether it's better or worse than.
I think we recorded that. I think we talked about that after the battery died, but whatever.
Right. Well, we need
that,
to. We
that's the plan. You'll hear about it next week if you happen to.
We need to. That, I think that's it.
Yeah. Do you know what you're going to show?
I think next week's film is going to be Class of 1984.
Okay.
Which I've discussed with you, but we've never watched it.
Yeah.
I'm fucking excited to watch that one. Right. I've not watched it in ages. So, yeah, that'll be it. So, next week, same bat channel, same bat network, whatever it is. 3-1 on this beautiful end-in summer night in Chicago. Tucker pulls the ground ball to the right side.